Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
But first, a lot of Defense Department facilities, from barracks to workplaces, are in pretty bad shape. And because of consistent maintenance shortfalls, things are generally getting worse. So as part of a new strategy for defense communities, the department is trying a new approach. It's seeking permission from Congress to test a series of pilot projects that would demolish old buildings and consolidate facilities into what they call livable communities. Federal News Network's Jared Serbu has the details.
In a legislative proposal the department sent to Capitol Hill last week, officials asked Congress for permission to test the new demolition and consolidation ideas at five locations over the next 3 years, spending up to $25 million at each site. It would be one of the first large tests of the new Resilient and Healthy Defense Community Strategy the department published in February. Brendan Owens is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Energy, Installations, and Environment.
Working with the military departments on three lines of effort to guide our infrastructure investments: adopting human-centered requirements, optimizing our footprint, and transforming our portfolio management. The department has codified these priorities into the Resilient and Healthy Defense Community Strategy, which will ensure that our spaces are healthy, safe, functional, resilient, and enhance the quality of life and readiness of our service members, their families, and the civilian workforce. The RHDC lays out key strategic enablers that underpin these efforts, and we look forward to sharing with this committee and working in partnership to deliver on these quality of life improvements. Together, our efforts will drive changes across the defense infrastructure enterprise and ensure that it is managed as a strategic asset to promote the well-being of our total force.
Owens testifying before the House Armed Services Committee earlier this week. The basic idea is to spend military construction funding to tear down old buildings that have fallen into disrepair and move their occupants or employees into new facilities that cost a lot less to maintain. And while that sounds fairly straightforward, defense officials say that under existing law, it's actually not. That's mainly because of how DOD's budget is allocated and the strict controls over different colors of money. As of now, for the military services to do the kind of facility realignment they'd like to, they'd need to plan military construction funding to build the new facilities in one budget year and then move the new tenants in. But funding for the demolition of the old buildings would have to come separately, likely in an entirely different budget year, because MILCON accounts can't be used to fund demolition projects. That's not to say demolition isn't happening, though. Installation officials say it's often the best way to solve the problem of older facilities becoming too expensive to maintain. Ravi Chaudhary, the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Installations, Energy, and Environment, says his service is increasing its demolition budget to help reduce its $46 billion backlog in facility maintenance.
We're going to get it by tripling our demo rate. And when I say backlog $46 billion, that's the total of all of our assets. Mm-hmm. We're going to get at that by reducing our inventory and utilizing privatization to reduce the denominator so that those backlogs come. So turning over things with privatization activities allows us to reduce that backlog, but also we're roughly quadrupling our demo from roughly $30 million a year to about $140 to $160 million per year across the FITIP.
But as of now, those backlogs are growing across the services. That's partly because of chronic underfunding in DOD's facility sustainment, restoration, and modernization accounts. The Pentagon's current goal is to fund those accounts to 90% of the level that its models say is needed to keep facilities from deteriorating. But the military services routinely fall short of even that goal. There is one large exception this year, though: military barracks, sometimes called unaccompanied housing. In the wake of a scathing GAO report last year on barracks conditions, each service is now funding barracks maintenance to 100% of their model's funding requirement. Rachel Jacobson is the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment.
The Army recognizes that we have a sizable backlog of deferred maintenance needs for hundreds of thousands of buildings. This deferred maintenance, which emerged over the course of many years, has serious repercussions, as we have seen with barracks. We welcome the congressional focus on these issues, as evidenced in both the 2024 NDAA and the recent Quality of Life report. Simply put, any increase in our inventory of poor and failing barracks for any reason is unacceptable and must be reversed. And barracks that are in good condition must stay that way. That is why the Army is requesting 100% of the funding required for barrack sustainment. We are also taking a number of steps to improve the soldier experience in new and renovated barracks, both in living spaces and communal areas.
But even if the service has managed to keep their barracks from degrading any further, across their broader portfolios, officials say they simply have more facilities than they can afford to maintain, and the issues aren't limited to housing. In the Marine Corps, for example, each building that houses division and battalion headquarters commands is now rated as in poor or failing condition. Meredith Berger is the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy Installations and Environment.
The majority of our infrastructure, whether barracks, utilities, or our public shipyards, is not in the shape it should be. As an institution, we have allowed these assets to degrade over time. We have accumulated and deferred significant risk and allowed the risk to accumulate and compound. And the adversary always has a say. Whether we're talking about kinetics and components, or water and weather, we've seen increased external impacts that reduce our ability to be resilient and respond, with the emergent urgent frequently overtaking the enduring important in a constrained funding environment. No matter what the cost is readiness, and our sailors and Marines shoulder the consequences.
Jared Serbu, Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Check out Jared's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts. with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's It's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.